This is KPOO San Francisco 89.5 FM. You have reached Reality Sandwich. I'm Julie Matthews, a certified nutrition consultant with Healthful Living. And every week, every Thursday at noon, we have our radio show, Reality Sandwich, a palatable taste of the truth where we provide you topics of the mind, body, our planet. And today we have on an amazing guest, or actually a couple guests, who are going to be talking about Lyme disease. And it's very interesting because right around the time when I found out about these two guests, I have had several clients ask me about Lyme disease and who they could contact and what they need to know and all of that. So hopefully you're all listening, or you can always listen online to the recording afterwards at healthfulliving.org if you have friends or family members that weren't able to listen into the show, because it's going to be a very informative show of things you probably haven't heard in the topic of Lyme disease before. So our first guest is going to be Dr. Ray Stricker, who is an MD. He's a physician who specializes in hematology and immunology, and we're going to talk to him about Lyme disease and what it's all about and what's going on and how we can help people. And then the second half of the show is going to be with Dr. Nick Harris, who is the president and CEO of a lab in Palo Alto that runs these tests called Igenix. So let's see if we can get Dr. Stricker on the phone. Dr. Stricker, are you there?
I'm here, Julie.
Oh, great. I'm so glad to have you on.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So maybe you can give a little bit of background on yourself and who you are and how you got involved in Lyme disease before we get started.
Well, I got in Lyme disease totally by accident. I'm a hematologist by training, and I was working with AIDS patients. And as part of that, I was looking at testing for AIDS. And while we were doing that, we happened to get some patients with Lyme disease, and we found that they had a peculiar abnormality in their immune testing, and that sort of got me interested in the disease, and it also opened the floodgates for what has been a very poorly characterized disease, unfortunately.
And for people, I'm sure, hopefully at this point, everybody's at least heard of Lyme disease, but maybe you can just explain to people out there that maybe haven't had any personal or family experience with this, what is Lyme disease actually?
Well, Lyme disease was originally described in Lyme, Connecticut, which is where the name comes from, in around 1975, when a group of people developed severe joint pain and swelling after getting bitten by ticks. And since that time, the disease has been recognized as a bacteria called Borrelia, which is transmitted by the bite of a tick and which can cause multiple symptoms, from arthritis to neurologic disease and to heart disease. And this is a very difficult disease to treat because it does involve a lot of different parts of the body.
So how would somebody know, being, like you said, the symptoms are so diverse, what should people do if they suspect something?
Well, the best treatment for Lyme disease is to avoid tick bites, but with our society, especially here in California, where people are out hiking and camping and getting exposed to ticks quite a bit, tick avoidance is very important, and there are some ways to do that. The classic presentation of Lyme disease is a tick bite with a very characteristic bullseye rash, which you can see at the site of the bite, and that is often followed by some symptoms like flu-like symptoms, fever, joint pain, muscle aches. And in that situation, if the disease is treated promptly, it can be very easy to treat. The problem is, a lot of times, people don't know they've been bitten by a tick, they don't have the rash, and then they may develop a bunch of symptoms that are much harder to diagnose, and that really is why this has become more of a controversial disease.
So, you know, are there other ways other than ticks to pass this along?
Well, not that has ever been documented. There is some speculation that other insects may transmit the disease, but that has never been proven. And it's really the tick bite that seems to be the main way of transmitting the disease.
And this exists, of course, all around the country, correct, this disease?
It does. It was originally described, as I said, in Connecticut, and is endemic or very common in the northeastern part of the country. But in recent years, we've seen a lot more of the disease in the upper Midwest, Wisconsin, Minnesota, those states, and also in Northern California. This is now considered an endemic area where the disease is relatively common.
So being that it's common here, are doctors well aware of this disease and the symptoms?
Well, unfortunately not. Most doctors think of it as an East Coast disease where it was first described. They aren't really very aware of the disease in Northern California, even though we're seeing more and more studies showing that the tick infection rate in Northern California can be equivalent to the infection rate on the East Coast. So more people are getting exposed to these infected ticks, and yet doctors really are not that aware that it exists here.
Now, are doctors on the East Coast, are they more savvy about this? Do they have different testing methods or treatment methods than we because they're more savvy in this?
Well, one of the problems is that the testing methods are not very sensitive. The commercial tests that exist may miss up to 60 or 70% of cases. So Lyme disease really remains a clinical diagnosis with a picture of a tick bite and a rash or symptoms consistent with infection with the Lyme bacteria. And again, it's kind of up to the doctor to make that diagnosis. On the East Coast, a lot of doctors really are tuned into that. And if someone comes from an area where there are a lot of ticks and Lyme disease, they may make the diagnosis without any testing and just treat accordingly. Unfortunately, here, where doctors aren't as familiar with the disease, very often they may miss the diagnosis and not treat the patient, and that is a big problem. Or they may depend on these insensitive lab tests that also fail to confirm the disease, and that's also a problem.
So give us an example, if you have one. I know that there's quite a number of fairly famous people in the recent past that have brought some exposure to this disease so people can be more aware of what their symptoms might be. But I don't know if you have a particular case or something that you can explain to us what happens kind of with the progression of this disease or what happens over time if it's not caught at the beginning.
Right. Well, as a very good example, many of you may know that Amy Tan had neurologic Lyme disease, and she wrote about this in her latest book. And in her case, she developed severe neurologic symptoms, including hallucinations and difficulty thinking. And, you know, here's a woman who had written beautiful novels and couldn't really put a sentence together. And she went from doctor to doctor, and no one could diagnose her illness. And finally, she had appropriate testing done and was diagnosed with the disease and treated and got all better. And, you know, she has been very public about her illness, which is very helpful. There are a number of other people who have similar stories. That's really a very common story with neurologic Lyme disease. And unfortunately, the diagnosis is often missed, and patients end up going from doctor to doctor without getting a diagnosis until somebody does the right testing.
Wow, that seems amazing that you could go around with hallucinations and yet nobody can tell you what's wrong and nobody can tell you how to help you.
Well, there are always other possibilities, but very often patients will come to me, for example, with $1 million workup. They've had every other test done and it's all been negative. And that's really why a good laboratory such as Igenix, and I know you're going to talk to Nick Harris who runs that lab, a good laboratory is very, very important for the diagnosis of Lyme disease.
So I understand that there's kind of two different schools of thought on this as far as it being chronic or not. What's your opinion on this? Will it go away by itself? Does it get progressively worse? Does it hide for many years?
Well, there are two schools of thought. One school, which is represented by many infectious disease doctors, doesn't believe in chronic Lyme disease or thinks that it's extremely rare or non-existent. And that is a problem because basically they don't believe in chronic infection with the Lyme bacteria. The other school of thought, which is represented by the International Lyme and Associated Diseases Society, among others, believes that Lyme disease can cause a chronic infection that can produce these chronic symptoms. And this may be very difficult to treat, and it requires prolonged antibiotic treatment.
So are there some people that get Lyme disease and don't do anything and it just goes away within a short period of time, or does something have to be done in order for it to go away?
Well, if the disease isn't treated, very often patients will improve, and the reason for that is that their immune system will kind of take over for a while and control the infection. But eventually what happens is the disease sort of gets the upper hand and the immune system finally kind of gives out, and then people may get sick, and it may be months to years later that they develop all these symptoms.
Mm.
And at that point, of course, they don't remember a tick bite, they don't remember what might have caused this, and then it becomes much more difficult to make the diagnosis. So that's why it really is important to treat the disease as early as possible, because the longer it goes without treatment, the harder it is to treat.
So if someone finds out that, let's say they were camping, they had an idea, they might have gotten a tick bite, they go, they find out, yes, they did, yes, they got this infection. If it's caught at the beginning, what's the course of treatment?
The treatment early on is with oral antibiotics. Things like doxycycline and amoxicillin are still the standard of treatment for early disease. But again, it depends on how early it is in the course of disease, because beyond several months, the disease may already have disseminated and require more treatment. And the other issue is that the length of treatment may be crucial. There are some guidelines that say that 2 to 3 weeks of antibiotics cures everybody. The experience of ILADS physicians is that that's not true, that people often need longer treatment, even early on, to get rid of the bacteria, and we're talking about, you know, 6 weeks to 3 months, something along those lines.
So I'm curious, being a holistic-minded person, and are, of course, sometimes medical interventions and antibiotics and things are necessary, and I'm all for that when it's necessary. Do people, are there other natural things that people can do in conjunction or instead of, or other ways of addressing this as well?
Well, certainly eating a healthy diet is important. And I often tell my patients that, in fact, I have the healthiest patients in the world, because they're the ones who are out hiking and camping and exercising and eating healthy and doing all the right things. Unfortunately, when they come in contact with this bacteria transmitted by a tick, it gives them something that really can't be overcome by nutrition and diet and exercise. Because for an infectious disease, the only known treatment and cure that we have is antibiotic therapy. So in that situation, I think that nutrition certainly is important, but I think it's secondary to treating the infection.
Mm-hmm. And if it's caught at the beginning, it sounds like it's much easier to do that.
That's correct.
Now, you had mentioned that if this persists for several months, it can disseminate into other places. What does it look like if it progresses beyond the short term?
Well, people can get a multi-system infection. They can get involvement of lots of different parts of the body, including significant joint pain and swelling, muscle aches. Severe fatigue is very often a symptom, a very prominent symptom of chronic Lyme disease. People have fibromyalgia-type symptoms where they get these muscle pains that are severe. Also, neurologic symptoms can be very prominent, such as a facial nerve palsy, where people get paralysis of one side of the face. Things like seizures can happen. And other types of symptoms, psychiatric symptoms, including problems with depression and memory loss. And all of these types of neurologic symptoms can occur with chronic disease. The third general area that's involved is the heart, and people can get all kinds of heart problems with abnormal heart rhythm. Interestingly, heart problems are much less common on the West Coast than on the East Coast with Lyme disease.
Hmm.
We don't see as much of that here, and it may have something to do with the strain of the bacteria that we see here. There are over 100 strains of the Lyme bacteria in the United States, and there are over 300 strains worldwide, so it may have something to do with the strains that we have here that are different from the strains on the East Coast.
That's fascinating. So when you say that it disseminates to other parts of the body, what happens? The bacteria goes from a concentrated location to a more of getting into different parts of the body and then
exactly.
affecting? Okay.
That's a good question. The bacteria basically goes from the skin, where the tick bites, to all of the organs in the body. And what it can do is it burrows into these different tissues, and it's very good at getting into deep tissues like connective tissue and also into the brain. And in those tissues, it can cause significant inflammation, and it's the inflammatory response that really causes a lot of these symptoms, like the joint symptoms and the muscle aches, and also the brain symptoms as well, because you're basically getting inflammation in the brain that causes a lot of problems with memory and cognitive function.
Hmm. So what is the treatment? How does it differ for someone that is in more of these advanced stages?
Well, again, it varies from patient to patient, but for patients with musculoskeletal symptoms, with muscle and joint involvement, very often you have to do more intensive oral antibiotic therapy. For patients with neurologic disease, very often the treatment is intravenous antibiotics or intramuscular antibiotic treatment with something like penicillin. So it does vary according to the patient and the type of symptoms that are there.
Is the time for treatment, the duration of treatment longer for those more chronic people?
It generally is. It's not uncommon for people with chronic infection to require many months or even more than a year of treatment to get better. And often there's a need to rotate treatments to try different antibiotic regimens. And that brings up another issue, which is that ticks have been called sewers of infection. And they often not only transmit Lyme disease, but they may transmit other bacterial agents that can cause additional symptoms and can complicate the Lyme disease. So it's important to test not just for Lyme disease, but for these co-infections that can also cause problems.
So for people that are listening, what might be some of these co-infections that they would want to ask about?
Well, for example, the ones that are most common here would be something like Babesia or Anaplasma or Ehrlichia or Bartonella. Those are probably the four most common that we see in California. In other places, there are things like Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever, which we don't really see much of here, or Relapsing Fever, which is seen in other parts of the country due to other bacteria.
Wow. So what can people do if they suspect that they may have Lyme disease? Should they go to their regular doctor? Should they search out someone that's a specialist in this area?
Well, as I said, many doctors are unfamiliar with this disease, although we're trying to educate them as much as possible. Many patients will, of course, these days first go to the Internet. And we have a very good website for the International Lyme and Associated Diseases Society, or ILADS, at www.ilads.org, which can give a lot of information about Lyme disease. There's also a very large patient support group nationwide called the Lyme Disease Association, which also has a website, and patients can seek out information through that website as well.
Great. So for people that are listening, the spelling on the International Lyme and Associated Diseases Society is just how it sounds. It's ILADS. It's the acronym for that.
That's correct.
ILADS.org.
Correct.
So that's really helpful for people. And so there are doctors, of course, such as yourself in this area that can help people get more specific testing done.
Yes, there are doctors who are familiar with Lyme disease in our area, and we're fortunate that they can do more specific testing and treat patients if they need it.
What's the difference between somebody that knows knows what they're doing and doesn't? Is it simply a matter of running a different test to identify the disease in general, or is it different treatments based on different types of things that might show up from the test results?
Yeah, you know, I used to have a slide that was like David Letterman's top 10 reasons why a patient doesn't have Lyme disease.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically just lack of awareness of the disease. And so the first thing is to be aware that Lyme disease exists here and to listen to the patient, listen to the symptoms, and then try to treat accordingly if this is a suggestive story for Lyme disease. Beyond that, having a lab like Igenix, for example, that does a good job of testing can be very useful to support the diagnosis. And then knowing about the protocols for treatment is very important, and that's where ILADS comes in, because we do have guidelines for treatment of the disease that are very useful for physicians.
So what is this underreported, the numbers on this, based on the fact that the test results, and we'll talk to Dr. Harrison a little bit to really understand the labs themselves, but what do we have any sense of what this underreporting looks like?
Well, to give you an example, the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, keeps track of Lyme disease nationwide. They use a surveillance reporting system, which is very insensitive. And in the last year that this was reported, there were 24,000 cases of Lyme disease around the country. Now, the CDC itself admits that this number is an underreporting by a factor of about 10. So
wow.
There may be as many as 240,000, 250,000 cases of Lyme disease every year in the United States, and yet only 10% of those are reported.
Wow, that's unbelievable. And a lot of that is because of the testing methods not showing it?
Exactly. The testing methods, again, are not geared to diagnosis. They're geared to surveillance, which is a different method, and that's why they're so insensitive.
Wow. So if people want to find out more about you, how can they get a hold of you?
They can certainly find me through the ILADS website and also through my practice in San Francisco.
And so that's ILADS.org.
That's correct.
And thank you, Dr. Stricker, so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Julie.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay. So we'll see if we can get Dr. Harris on the line, and he can tell us a lot more about this condition and this lab testing, which sounds like the real missing link to all of this that's creating a lot of the misreporting and inability for people to get treated properly. So while we're waiting here, I will go ahead and put on... We'll take a little short break here for some music, and when we come back, we will go ahead and have Dr. Harris on the line. So stay tuned.
With intentions good.
Okay, you are listening to KPOO San Francisco 89.5 FM. You are listening to Reality Sandwich, and we are talking about Lyme disease today. And we were just speaking with Dr. Stricker, who is an MD who works extensively with Lyme disease. And now, in the second half, we are going to talk to Dr. Nick Harris, who is the CEO and president of Igenix Lab, the lab that we were talking about earlier. So let's see if we can get Dr. Harris on the line. Are you there?
I'm there.
All right. Great. It's great to have you on.
Good to be there.
So I want to find out, so it sounds like the big controversy or the big problem here is that the testing methods aren't identifying most cases of Lyme, and we know that Lyme seems to get more and more progressively worse and difficult to treat over time. So if people don't have a way to get good testing, then they're prolonging their treatment. So I would love to find out from you, what is going on with these test results? What's the standard test that I suppose it's the CDC uses to identify Lyme?
Well, the standard test that they use is called an ELISA. It's an antibody-based test. And the follow-up, if the ELISA is positive, is a Western blot. Now, part of the problem we're having is that these tests were designed for early Lyme, and this was a definition that they said the patient had to have a rash, knowledge of a tick bite, and the patients that they looked at were within 3 to 4 to 5 months after that tick bite. And if you have the rash and you have the tick bite, those tests work. The problem is most people, and I think it's at the level of 80 to 90%, don't remember a tick bite, did not have a rash. So people are coming in many months, if not years, after that tick bite, or when the symptoms appear after some event, and the standard tests don't work. And one of the reasons why Igenix has been so successful is that we're one of the only laboratories in the country that do not require an ELISA. Since we're a reference laboratory, we don't have to require an ELISA before we do the Western blot. And our Western blot was designed in 1989 to work in all phases of Lyme, not just early Lyme. So that's why our numbers are much higher and much more sensitive than the standard laboratory.
Now, so this Western blot, is that in the standard population or standard course of treatment, is that Western blot only done then after a positive on the ELISA?
That is correct.
Okay, and so if that doesn't come up positive, they don't even do the second half.
Right, and one of the things that we're trying to do, and there was a meeting just last week with the CDC, with the Lyme Disease Association, trying to get the CDC to stop, to put a statement out that says what they want for statistics, which is called surveillance, is not necessary for diagnostics.
Mm.
But everybody falls back on the CDC statement of an ELISA first, followed by a Western blot if the ELISA is positive. So the whole industry, physicians, insurers, kind of followed the CDC, even though their criteria were designed for a national type reporting,
mm-hmm.
not the diagnosis of a patient.
So why is it, you had this meeting with them the other day, why is it that, I mean, they're clearly smart people, why are they not currently on board with all of this?
I don't know the why.
I guess that would be the million-dollar question, right?
Yeah, maybe a billion-dollar question when it comes to Lyme disease.
I find it really peculiar, and I almost don't even know what to ask next because I find it so,
mind-boggling.
Yes.
What will happen if they open up the testing? There will be a lot more patients, obviously, that will be detected. because there are so many patients that get thrown into convenient categories today: fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue, where there's very little cost to insurers, HMOs, because the medicines and things that patients can take, the neutral pharmaceuticals, are usually not covered.
Mm-hmm.
Many of those patients will or do have Lyme disease, and when treated with the appropriate course of antibiotics, will improve.
Wow. So it sounds like there are a variety of ways. You can go to a doctor and you can get a test that's not effective, or you can go to a doctor and get a test like Igenix does that is going to be much more sensitive and be much more likely to detect this.
Correct. And also, knowledge will help. I mean, if a patient, for example, hikes on Mount Tam on the weekend, finds a tick, goes to the emergency room, they'll pull off the tick, throw the tick away, and then they'll do an ELISA. Now, the concept of doing testing is fine, but that ELISA is not going to be positive for 6 or 8 weeks.
Mm.
So it goes down in the record, well, we tested you for Lyme and you were negative.
Ah.
And that's the education part.
And I'm guessing doctors aren't aware of this since they're the ones that are running this test?
Correct.
Wow.
And that's what, I mean, ILADS exists out there. I'm sure Dr. Stricker talked about ILADS.
Mm-hmm.
There's CALDA, the California Lyme Disease Association. The goals of both of these nonprofits is education. If we can educate the doctors, if we can educate the health community, it can be much better. I mean, with the tests that exist out there, without even developing new tests, with the tests that exist out there, we would have a much better chance as a community to find the patients with Lyme disease.
So going back to the story of someone has a tick bite or even they have a tick on them and they go to the emergency room or something, what should they do?
Well, first of all, they shouldn't throw the tick away. Because the tick, if that's the only one that bit them, has all the information in it.
Hmm.
So if the tick's positive, sure, it may take a week or two to get the answer back, but that answer will say the patient needs to go on antibiotics, doesn't need to go on antibiotics. And don't forget, Lyme is not the only disease transmitted by the ticks.
Mm-hmm.
There's multiple diseases, and those ticks are reservoirs, but they can be tested.
Hmm.
They can be tested at some levels in reference laboratories like ours, and they can be tested on the cheap at public health service laboratories.
So I have just a totally random question that came to me. What if you're hiking with your dog? I'm assuming other animals other than humans can get affected by this disease?
Other animals can get affected by the disease, but even more so. I mean, let's say you have what I think it's called Advantage or something like that you can give dogs so they don't get bit by ticks.
Mm-hmm.
But that only affects the tick that's trying to bite the dog. If you have a dog with a long hair, that dog may have 50 ticks on him. So when you bring the dog back in the house, you now have 50 ticks, many the size of poppy seeds, looking around for a warm body.
Oh, boy. Not good.
One of the things we noticed in the East Coast were from hunters coming back after their annual deer hunt, dropping their clothes in the laundry room for the to wash. And off comes the ticks.
Hmm. So, given all of that, do you have any thoughts on what people can do, since those are probably situations many people will be in with their pets? Or
well, they need to really check out their pet before they bring the pet in the house. If they have, a dog
and, you know, you live in back up into a nice area where there's oak trees with leaf litter, whether in your backyard or close by. If that dog's running outside, every time it comes back in, it should be inspected.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, a lot of times people have the dog sleeping in their beds.
Mm-hmm. I know that one.
I mean, we're lucky in a sense in California that for most parts of the state, from June through November, the ticks are positive at no more than 2% versus 80 to 90% on the East Coast.
Oh, boy.
Now, you're in Mendocino and certain areas of Marin, you know, it's going to be a higher amount. And from December through June, the ticks are many times higher than that positive, because those are the nymphal ticks, the hardest ones to see.
And what time of the year was that?
That's from December through June.
Interesting. I would think, I know myself included, would have thought that the summertime where it seems like everything's out and about would be a worse, and people are out and about, I suppose, more exposure. But in reality, the if you do get exposed in the winter months, there's some additional level of challenge with that.
Mm-hmm. And you can go into an area and predict where the ticks are, because look for the green. It's going to be the north-facing parts of a valley, the east-facing parts of a valley where you have the green. I mean, those are the places where you're going to find the greatest concentration of ticks in the middle of summer.
Hmm.
The dry areas, forget it. The ticks leave those areas.
Ah, very interesting to know. So these are all things that people can, I'm guessing, go on iLads and probably find out a whole bunch of information on how to keep themselves safe and how to get some idea if they should go in for some testing.
And, yeah, in a lot of parts of the country, people use mosquito spray. We don't use it out here in California. We're fortunate for that. But when hiking in the woods, it's not a bad idea to wear long pants, tan in color, sprayed with permethrin.
And tell us what that is. Is
permethrin's
that
a spray that kills ticks.
Hmm.
And it's not to be sprayed on the body, but to be sprayed on the clothes, the shoes, pants, shirts, or the buzz-off clothing that's available. Orvis is a company that has it, but there's other ones that have this buzz-off clothing that has the permethrin built into the fabric, and that's really, really helpful.
So
it keeps the ticks and the mosquitoes away.
I'm guessing that's a poison, I'm guessing.
Well, it's a insecticide, but it's not harmful to people on clothing.
Got it. Is there some? I'm curious about your lab. How did you come about determining this? Do you do a different type of a Western blot than some people? What makes Igenix able to detect more of these cases?
Well, this Western blot that we do was developed in 1989 when our lab was part of the 3M Corporation, and it was developed to look at all phases of disease. The other Western blot that came into the marketplace was in 1995 when the country thought they were going to get a Lyme vaccine. So that blot was designed in a different way. Some of the markers that we use were not included in that blot. So it's entirely different levels.
Hmm.
We've also, I mean, there's another test that we do that's used a lot in medicine for hepatitis, for HIV. It's a test for the DNA of an organism. It's called a polymerase chain reaction, or PCR. I mean, that's the test of choice for most infectious diseases. The CDC does not accept it for Lyme yet.
Yeah, can you tell me a little? I was reading an article about the CDC and the FDA and all of their, what they agree with and approve of and all that stuff. Is there some controversy or argument going on there?
Well, definitely. I mean, first of all, the CDC makes statements and you can't argue with them. They'll say, well, you should use a lab that uses tests that are FDA approved. Well, a reference laboratory, which is the major big labs around the country, we're a reference laboratory. We don't need to use FDA approved tests. If we develop a test by ourselves, we have certain standards we have to follow, and we're inspected on a very regular basis. And every few months, we get samples from different agencies around the country for whether it be for Lyme or hepatitis or HIV, and we have to perform at the 90% level. So there's a check period that labs have to follow, but we don't need to have FDA-approved tests. FDA-approved tests are those tests that are developed by a manufacturer to sell to other companies.
Mm.
If you're developing the test for yourself, you only have to follow the laws of laboratory testing, the Medicare laws, and you have to take frequent proficiency tests. So that's part of the CDC statements are entirely bogus.
Hmm.
And then the fact that there's the two definitions of early Lyme versus persistent or chronic Lyme. Well, if patients have had a disease for multiple years, that's persistent disease or mm-hmm. chronic disease. That is not recognized yet by the CDC or by the Infectious Disease Society.
Okay, so when you say the CDC doesn't recognize it, do they say that, are they actually saying that Lyme disease did not cause the symptoms that this person is having three years later?
Right. Or if the patient was treated, let's say a patient had a defined case of Lyme disease, was treated for 30 days. The statement will be, anything that patient now has can't be Lyme disease because it was treated for 30 days. So it must be post-Lyme, non-infectious. Again, I mean, we treat syphilis, TB, HIV, just a range of diseases. There's you know, bacterial infections you get in hospitals that may be treated for a year. So to make an assumption because someone's treated with a low dose of antibiotic for 30 days that the infection has to be gone doesn't make any logical sense. So these are the arguments that are going around where it's now to the point where the patients, because they're the stakeholders, just like patients with HIV and chronic fatigue are getting angry at the government, and it's turning into a political movement because that's how things change.
Mm.
And that's how we were able to, how the, you know, part of the Lyme community was able to get a meeting with the CDC.
I would assume that this is creates a lot more problems, well, in addition to the worst problem, which is that they can't get the correct treatment. But I'm assuming this has implications for insurance and what they believe this person really has and whether they're going to cover it.
Definitely, because it's much less expensive for the insurance company to say, well, we follow the IDSA guidelines, which says 30 days works, versus the ILADS guidelines, which say you treat a patient for 2 months after they feel good.
Makes sense.
It's much less money for those agencies.
Yeah, it doesn't really seem to make much sense to me that there's an assumption that after 30 days, every single 100% of all human beings in 30 days will, none of them will have the Lyme disease after. That seems to make no sense, since how many other viruses and bacteria and things do we know that it really depends on the individual person and what else is going on with them and how their immune system's working and all of those things. It's just bizarre to me that these people that are so smart couldn't come up with a common sense answer that maybe some people, maybe there's a percentage of the people that aren't, quote, cured after 30 days.
You're right. You're entirely correct. And that's bothered a lot of us because these are supposed to be really, really smart people.
Yeah.
Why can't they see it? I mean, they see it if it's in their family, but they don't see it for the general population.
Right. Well, anything, since we have you on the line, anything for people that are out there, since the word hasn't gotten out to the mainstream, but we have the ability to be talking to some listeners right now, is there anything else that you think that you want to let the public know about while we're on the subject?
Well, I think that the public, the more aware the public is with ways to protect themselves, what's really available out there, the better off they're protected. They can fight the insurers, they can get different doctors, but they need to know the questions to ask. I mean, for example, if someone tests positive for Lyme disease, you have part of an answer, but the patient needs to explore, the doctor needs to explore on that patient, does a patient have a co-infection?
Hmm.
Does a patient have Babesia, Ehrlichia, Bartonella? Also, people think, oh, I have Lyme, I must have got it in my backyard or, you know, last week. Where did you travel to? I mean, we're not, the U.S. has a lot of Lyme, but Eastern Europe has more.
Hmm.
I mean, it's unbelievable when you get into the Eastern Europe areas. And I'm not aware of any country, except maybe something in the Middle East, that Lyme is not in their environment.
Do we know what, and this might be a whole topic, but do we know what caused Lyme or spread Lyme or created it or what it's a derivative of or anything about it from that perspective?
No, we don't. I mean, it's a spirochete. It, when looking at it, it doesn't look a whole lot different than syphilis. But that's where the similarity ends, because syphilis is a fairly fast-growing organism. Lyme is a very slow-growing organism, although you can't culture syphilis. You can't grow it in the laboratory. You can grow Lyme in the laboratory.
Hmm.
And it can be a very insidious, staying around for a long time. It affects all the organ systems. I mean, there are patients that end up with a diagnosis of MS or Lou Gehrig's disease that it was Lyme. The symptoms can confuse and look similar to other types of diseases. Even patients that get a diagnosis of systemic lupus just because they have anti-nuclear antibodies. Well, you can get anti-nuclear antibodies from Lyme disease.
Oh.
So there's a whole range of different... This is a masquerading disease. There's a whole, even neuropsych, there's a group of psychiatrists that are looking at patients in their environment and not just using the psychiatric modifying drugs, but also treating the patients with antibiotics.
So for the cases of people that have had this for several years and they have some lupus diagnosis or some MS diagnosis or something. And so clearly they have some pretty strong symptoms that have lasted for a long time. Is there, are they going to, if they go to a lab like yours and they get a test like this, are, is it going to be detected in most cases? And is it treatable in most cases? Or is there a point where you really need to catch it?
You know, if they have MS-like symptoms that are induced by Lyme, 90 to 95% of the time it will be detectable at the laboratory, and these patients can be treated, and in many cases the disease will be improved. Whether you find a patient with Lyme disease many years and you cure it, that gets harder.
Right.
But there's a lot of diseases people live with, whether it be, high blood pressure or something like that. You're going to be on a medicine for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
If you take antibiotics judiciously with probiotics, you can be on antibiotics for a long time. If a child that's about 11 or 12 years old has a bad case of acne, many times they're going to be put on a dose of doxycycline for 10 to 12 years. That Lyme patients would love to be put on that dose.
Hmm. Well, I'm glad you mentioned the probiotics, because we can certainly help balance things out in the face of the need for some of these strong medications.
That's right. And that part, and I think that's one of the things that the doctors are now recognizing, that it's not just antibiotics. It's a whole course of improving the overall health of the patient,
mm-hmm.
whether it be with, healthy living, different homeopathic remedies plus antibiotics. It seems to be the smarter way to go.
I'm glad to hear that. Well, we are about out of time today, so I wanted to thank you, Dr. Harris, so much for being with us today.
It's a pleasure.
And I wanted to give that your contact information out for anybody that's listening. It is igenex.com, which is igenex.com. And then we've also been talking today about ILADS, ILADS.org. And there's also the Lyme Disease Association, LDA.org. So
Lyme Disease Association is spelled out, LymeDiseaseAssociation.org.
Oh, great. So thank you again.
Okay, thank you.
Have Bye-bye. A good one. Bye. You have been listening to KPOO San Francisco, 89.5 FM. This has been Julie Matthews, a certified nutrition consultant with Healthful Living. You can listen to any of our past shows at realitysandwichradio.com, as well as going to our main website, healthfulliving.org. Stay tuned every Thursday at noon on Reality Sandwich for a palatable taste of the truth on KPOO San Francisco, 89.5 FM. Thanks for listening.